Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects in our state with P.J. Leash. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, comes by every so often to talk with us, and we'll deal with a bit with mosquitoes, spongy moths, other bugs that also take your mind away from better things in life, and we'll take some insect-related questions from you as well, and maybe even some photos. Are you having problems with spongy moths? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. P.J. Leash, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Larry.
Well, mosquitoes are a concern for most of us at from one year to the next. What reports are you getting regarding mosquitoes this year?
Well, it's really dependent on where you are in the state. And I have been seeing for several weeks now a fair amount of activity in more northern parts of Wisconsin. Interestingly, things have been perhaps a bit behind schedule in the more southern parts of the state, but we are starting to see some activity and increase adults, and I'm expecting their numbers to increase even further in the coming weeks, simply because we have had plenty of rainfall and precipitation in most parts of the state so far this spring.
We sometimes hear people ask about spraying. Is it a good idea to spray your yard for mosquitoes? That probably doesn't do a lot of good.
Yeah, and it's a big topic when you think about it. And I think it's really important to understand that there are different types of mosquito treatments out there. And you have to understand the context where these might be used. So there are treatments called ULV, or ultra low volume treatments. And these are used not so much here in Wisconsin, but we use them more in southern parts of the U.S. where maybe there's a hurricane that comes through, or there's constant disease threat from some of the mosquito species that are abundant in an area. And the ULV, or ultra low volume treatments, are often applied with a large device on the back of a truck or sometimes from airplanes. And what those treatments do is they use a very tiny amount and they suspend it as these extremely small droplets. And with those treatments, those droplets disperse relatively quickly. So it's essentially a one-time strike. And we know from some research in the literature that those types of treatments don't seem to have a huge impact on beneficials in the area. So that's some good news about those treatments. However, if you are getting contacted about having your yard treated, those are different types of treatments. Those would be what we are referring to as a residual barrier treatment, or simply a barrier, sometimes a perimeter treatment. And what those treatments do is they apply a synthetic pyrethroid in many cases. And this is based upon a natural extract from certain types of chrysanthemums. But in the lab, the chemicals have been modified to make them longer lasting and more potent insects. So these are pretty broad spectrum products. If you went to the garden center or hardware store, most of the insecticide you'll find are synthetic pyrethroids. So they're very potent to a very, very wide range of insects. Now, when it comes to these residual barrier or barrier yard treatments, there's not a whole lot of research that has been done to look at the potential impacts on non-target insects, beneficial insects like pollinators, for example. But there have been a few studies out there. We know that there's been some work on monarchs, for example, and there's another study I've seen on honeybees, where basically these types of treatments that would be applied to yards, they produce a coating on vegetation. And the idea is there's a coating where mosquitoes are going to land and rest during the daytime, and it can help control them. But what these studies have found is it can actually harm some of these beneficial insects, like monarch caterpillars, like honeybees, sometimes even several weeks after application. And so if you are having your yard treated once a month or every 3-4 weeks throughout the entire growing season, that could really have some negative impacts on the insects around you. You have to think about all the other insects that are going to land on those treated plants. That could be other pollinators like bees, butterflies, moths, flies, and beetles, But especially this time of the year, I start thinking about fireflies because they're starting to pop out. And we know that fireflies like to land on plants. So you're right, Larry, there definitely are some concerns. And I think when it comes to the mosquito yard treatments, we need to see some more research done just to see how big or how significant those impacts are.
We have many callers online, so I think we should take some calls, PJ. Catherine in Random Lake will give you a chance. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning. I have black raspberry bushes, and at the end of the season last year, I saw that the Japanese beetle has found my black raspberry bushes. And with all what you're saying about spraying, I certainly don't want to kill health good bugs. But I want my black raspberries. So,
how big is your patch?
What's that space in between? I'm not going to pick them off by hand. I'm not going to do that.
How big is your patch?
What?
How big is your?
It's quite large because I planted some, and then the birds have planted lots of them.
Okay.
Way more than I could pick them off individually.
Okay.
Okay. Well, and the question that Larry just asked was going to be one of my first questions as well, because when you think about managing any insect pest, you really have to think about the matter of scale. Is this one single plant or is it acres upon acres of plants? Because the more space we're talking about, it simply takes more time and effort and resources to be able to deal with a pest. Surprisingly, I know you mentioned hand picking. That can actually make a difference. It has been shown in some research studies, especially if you do it early in the season, and there's an interesting reason for that. So often there's this myth that Japanese beetles have an aggregation pheromone, that they release the scent and it draws others to the same plant to feed on, and they really don't do that. They don't have that aggregation pheromone. What they do, though, is when a Japanese beetle starts to nibble on a plant and that plant is wounded, the plant is actually releasing volatile chemicals to the air. Other Japanese beetles can smell that. So the analogy I make is that it's essentially like blood in the water. You're going to draw more sharks into that area. So this one research study looked at preventing some of that initial damage early in the season, and they found it can actually help. But again, if you have a large patch, that may not be feasible. Some other potential considerations, now with raspberries, this may be hard to do, but for certain plants, we can actually cover the plants with what we call floating row cover. It's basically mesh netting that is small enough that the insects can't get to it. However, again, with raspberries or blackberries, you have thorns. Also, anytime you'd want to harvest, you'd have to remove that. And then there's also an issue of pollinator access. But sometimes for other plants, like certain garden herbs, like basil, that can be a good option. A few other things that you could consider. I know you had mentioned not necessarily wanting to spray for Japanese beetles, but there are some organic options that can work decent. And these are products that are going to be what we would refer to as narrow spectrum. Broad spectrum products can harm a very wide range of insects. Narrow spectrum products really only affect a fairly narrow wedge of the pie, so to speak. And there's one newer product out there that seems to do a pretty decent job for Japanese beetles. And I know it has a broad label. You can use it on veggies and fruits and a wide range of other things, including trees and shrubs. The product is called Beetle Gone, and it's got an exclamation point at the end of it. And it contains a type of BT or Bacillus thuringiensis. And this is a naturally occurring type of bacteria that happens to be toxic to certain types of insects. So we have BT Kurstaki, which is used to control caterpillars. We've got BT israelensis, which can control mosquito larvae and things like that and fly larvae. Then we've got BT Gallerii is the strain in this particular product, that Beetle Gone. And so that might be something that you could try. There's also some other organic options, such as azadirachtin is another one that you could try as well. So that gives you a couple things to try and see if that can make a difference. I will also say with Japanese beetles, their numbers can fluctuate from year to year. So just because you had a bad year last year doesn't necessarily mean you're going to see the same thing this year. So do keep that in mind as well. But hopefully that advice will give you some good guidance.
Catherine, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Rick in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I have seen a little bug in my kitchen that's about 3/8 inch long, shaped like a little cigar, banded with brown and black. And every year I see a few of them, but this year there just seems to be a whole bunch of them, which I haven't invited for lunch. I was curious what they are and why I might be seeing more of them, please.
Okay. So with the size, I do wonder, one possibility might be the larvae of carpet beetles. If the larvae have a hairy appearance at all, if you got them under magnification, that might be what they are. The larvae of carpet beetles are general scavengers. I would bet probably most homes in the state have at least a few around. I know I see them in my own house on occasion. And again, if I just see a few each year, really not a concern. If I were seeing, say, dozens, then that would be something, a situation where I would maybe do a little bit more detective work on it. But what might be helpful in this case, simply with the small size, if you're able to get either some photographs, and you could email those to me, or if you can collect a sample and actually mail it in to me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, then I can take a look at it under the microscope and really confirm exactly what it is in case it's something other than carpet beetles, and I could provide you some management advice at that time as well.
There you go. Thank you so much for that call. Jerry in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, hi, good morning. I have two questions on two different species of ants, and the first one is the what I call a patio ant. It's constantly boring up the dirt after a rain and then through the dry weather. I have little landmines out there, and I'm tired of always having to go out and broom in the spots where they dig up the dirt, and they just one continual cycle. I was wondering if there's anything I can do about that.
Yeah, good question. And I have been getting lots of reports of ant activity like that. There's a group of ants that we refer to as cornfield ants. It's the genus Lazius, and these can make little small mounds. However, there's actually a couple other ants that can do some similar things. Pavement ants can make some small mounds like that as well. So just from the description, I can't confirm exactly what type of ant it is. I'd probably guess that it's one of the cornfield group ants at the moment. Unfortunately, these can be a little frustrating just because sometimes they can be extremely abundant, especially if you have a soil type that they really like. And they often like soil that's maybe a little bit more on the sandy side of things. It's perhaps easier for them to dig in. There are some liquid insecticide products that could be used, for example, to drench the individual mounds. But if you have just like dozens or hundreds of bees in a yard, that's going to be a lot of work to be able to do. So in cases like that, I often suggest to folks, you know, kind of keep things in perspective. If they are causing issues really close to the house or between patio paver bricks, that's one thing. But if they're just out in the lawn, is it really worth doing something about it in a situation like that? You could also try for individual mounds if you are careful. Some very, very hot water and soak it in. That could be a consideration as well.
Good luck, Jerry. Thank you so much for calling. Greg in Wauwatosa, on to you now.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
This is Greg from Wauwatosa.
Yes, go ahead. I think we lost Greg from Wauwatosa. Well, I'll tell you what. P.J. Leash is our guest today. You can join in. You can email us to ideas@WPR.org or call us at 1-800-642-1234. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Tyler Ditter is our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today here in Wisconsin with our guest P.J. Leash. He directs the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And I think we have Greg from Wauwatosa back, so let's go there. Greg, hi.
Hi. My question is about fireflies. Do firefly larvae or grubs that are in the soil, are they affected by usual treatments for the generalized group called grubs?
Yeah, good question. And it's going to really depend a bit on the type of treatment that's applied. For example, there are the common treatments which usually use an insect from the neonicotinoid group. And those, I suspect, probably would have an impact on those. However, one thing to keep in mind is that for like a typical lawn area, I usually wouldn't expect to have tons of firefly larvae in the soil. Where I would expect to see more of them would be in locations such as mulch beds, near compost piles. I often see them around rotting logs and things like that. And so if the treatment is applied to the lawn and most of the firefly larvae are not in the lawn, but maybe nearby areas that are not treated, they may be avoiding the treatment just from, you know, that kind of separation in space.
There you go, Greg. Thank you so much. Ross in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Ross.
Hi, good morning, Larry and PJ. Just a couple of comments and then a simple question, I believe. Generally, I've been just trying to change my view of towards insects and seeing them less as pests, and we know that they can be annoying in their ways, but to see them really as a food source for the rest of the natural world, you know, other insects feeding on them, birds and such, that by supporting insects, we're supporting whatever ecosystem is by us. The other day, I was out in Crawford County and was cutting some multi-floor rows, and I heard this loud buzzing noise. And I sort of knew it had to be like a bee, but it wasn't in my ear, and it was loud. And after a little bit, I saw this patch of dead grass, and I sort of just gently lifted it up. And sure enough, there was this big bumblebee that was sort of like upside down as I sort of flipped this grass up. And I found the source of this buzzing noise. And then there was this really small bumblebee that was like by it, and I wasn't sure much about it if it was a worker. So I just kind of replaced it and walked away. So that was kind of my experience with the natural world. I'd never seen that. The question I have was, is there any benefit? I sometimes think in this hot weather and this time of the year that the bluebirds sometimes take a hit from insects. Is there any benefit to spraying the inside of the box with some kind of an insecticide? Do you think that would provide any kind of benefit to a bluebird boxes and bluebirds?
What do you think?
Yeah, so first...
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Larry.
No, I was just, you go ahead.
Okay. Well, first, the bumblebee observation, it sounds like you might have bumped into kind of a early stage nest. Our bumblebees have annual life cycles, meaning they die out naturally in the fall, except for the queens that will overwinter and produce new nests the following spring. And so when spring arrives, those queens, each individually, is going to look for some sheltered location. Often that may be a pre-existing chipmunk burrow or other burrow in the ground, but they will sometimes go to loose piles of grass, compost piles, if they can get amongst some roots where the soil is loose at like a base of a tree. They can certainly put nests in locations like that. I have heard of them plenty of times in kind of loose piles of grass or yard debris. So it sounds like you might have bumped into a nest. I hope you just kind of covered them back up and let them be to do their thing because they are, of course, beneficial insects as well. In terms of the bluebirds, that's a good question. I don't know a whole lot about bluebirds personally. I do know I have heard of cases where certain birds like bluebirds can get hit really hard if the black flies are out at the same time that the young are present in the nest. And if in a worst case scenario, that can sometimes cause the young birds to die just due to blood loss and things like that. However, I'm not aware of any studies I've seen that have really looked at like treatments inside of a nest box and if that really provides any sort of benefit. So until I saw some research on that, I'd probably hold off on doing a treatment like that.
There you go, Ross. Thanks so much. Maybe another caller has seen some information on that, but appreciate your call. Let's go to Donald in Bayfield County. Hi, Donald.
Hi, good morning. I'm curious. Sometimes mosquitoes fly near your face, and you can hear them buzzing. And other times they come in quiet, and they land on your face, and you don't hear any buzzing. Why is that different?
Hmm. Yeah, so that's an interesting observation. And there are differences known between all the mosquito species. And we know that essentially some mosquito species are very wary of getting close because if they land on you and bite, that's an opportunity where we can crush them and kill them, and that's the end of that bloodline, so to speak, for that individual mosquito. Whereas other mosquitoes aren't as wary. They just kind of come in and can be a little bit more aggressive. So again, each mosquito species does vary in terms of their habits and their behavior. If you think about mosquitoes here in Wisconsin, we have close to 60 species alone. So there is, of course, that variation. If you look at a larger perspective worldwide, we've got a couple thousand mosquito species. So they do definitely vary in behavior like that.
Interesting, Don. Thanks so much for calling. You know, just talking about that, repellents, you know, for the individual or a personal level, which repellents in your mind work the best?
There's actually a number of repellents that can work quite well. And one recommendation I would have, if you're curious, go online and do a Google search for EPA repellents, because the EPA actually has a really good website where they have a database that you can search pretty easily with scroll down menus and choose a couple options for both mosquitoes or ticks. When it comes to both mosquitoes and ticks, DEET has been along for decades. We know it works very well in a lot of cases. However, DEET sometimes can do some things we don't like. Certain plastics can react to it and it can kind of dissolve them. So if you aren't a fan of DEET, there are a number of alternatives that can work pretty much just as well. And these all have science backing them up. There are products out there containing picaridin. There's another one called IR3535. And if you're looking for more of a plant-based repellent, there are some out there that contain the ingredient oil of lemon eucalyptus. So all of those are good options. There are a few other ones in that EPA database online. So again, if you're curious to check that out, just do an online search for EPA repellents. You should be able to find that page pretty easily through a Google search. One other thing interesting about repellents I'll mention, Larry, is there's some work coming down the pipeline. There's a newer type of repellent, and I'm not aware of it being on the market yet, but it contains an ingredient called nootkatone, and this comes from natural plant extracts from plants such as grapefruits, and it seems to do a pretty good job. So that's something we can all watch for in the coming years, but at least at the moment, there's a solid handful of repellents that can all work and be very effective at helping keep mosquitoes at bay, but you always have to make sure to read the instructions and see, does it say to apply it to skin versus clothing? There can be differences there due to concentration, things like that. It's also going to tell you how often to reapply it. And so always make sure to read and follow all of those instructions on the repellent containers.
I remember having some mosquito repellent that I put in my fishing tackle box, and it leaked a little bit. It ate up one of my plastic lures, and I wondered whether or not it would be something good to be applying to my skin. Oh, my goodness. Colin, just on the mosquito business again, Colin emailed to ask you to discuss whether those Spartan mosquito tubes actually work. I don't know if you're familiar with them. You stick them out on the lawn, I guess, and I know they advertise that they will work for up to 30 days. Are you familiar with Spartan mosquito tubes?
Yeah, so I am generally familiar with those, and there's actually a number of these devices out there. I first started seeing them pop up in the market maybe 5 or so years ago, I want to say. And the general thought behind them was that they'd contain a bit of like sugar and yeast, and you fill them with water. And the thought is that they would produce carbon dioxide, so that it would attract mosquitoes. We know for a fact mosquitoes are attracted to carbon dioxide. That's how they actually find us from pretty good distances sometimes. And so the general concept was you would fill these devices with water, they release CO2, and then mosquitoes would come and go in the trap and ingest some of this. There was also, I believe, some salt in there, and it was supposed to take care of them. However, when I've looked in the scientific literature, I have not seen any studies to really back up those types of devices. I know some colleagues that work on mosquitoes have looked at the salt aspect to see if such as salt water would really have an impact, and they didn't see that there. So I know there's these devices out there being sold, but again, I just have not seen scientific evidence backing them up at this point as a reliable mosquito control method.
Talking the world of insects today with P.J. Leish from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Melissa emailed to ask you to talk about spongy moths and the difference between them and tent caterpillars.
So both are very relevant this time of the year. And actually, we have more than one species of tent caterpillar out there. So let's start with the spongy moth. And if you haven't heard of the term spongy moth before, you've undoubtedly heard of this insect, but it used to go by a different name. It formerly was called the gypsy moth, but the common name of the insect has gone through a name change process. So same species, same scientific name, Limantria dispar, but it's now commonly known as the spongy moth. And this one has been interesting because I've been watching it pretty closely for the last couple of years. We know that spongy moths can do very well when we have dry conditions, which we had in most parts of Wisconsin last spring, so a year ago at this time. And so that caused their numbers to kind of increase. I saw lots and lots of egg masses out there in my own neighborhood. And at this point, most of my reports of significant damage and lots of caterpillar activity have been from the southern third of Wisconsin at this point, especially south central and southeastern Wisconsin. So spongy moth is definitely active out there, causing some damage to landscape and forest area trees. I know that the Department of Ag has been doing some spraying in western parts of the state. At this point in the game, the spongy moth caterpillars are getting larger, and they're going to be causing progressively more damage. So I'm expecting I'm going to get even more reports over the next couple of weeks coming up here. Now, when you have large spongy moth caterpillars, they're actually fairly easy to identify because they have a whole series of pairs of these red and blue bumps or nodules running down the back of the insect. And the spongy moths are very fond of oaks in particular. They can go to a range of other trees, though, especially hardwood trees. A few conifers can be nibbled on from time to time. In terms of the tent caterpillars, though, the two species we have are the eastern tent caterpillar. There's also a forest tent caterpillar. And all three of these caterpillars are active this time of the year and are getting to be pretty good size. Now, the eastern tent caterpillar is one that you can actually identify driving down the interstate because they make silken tents in black cherry trees and closely related trees, so cherries, sometimes fruit trees and crab apples in home yards, things like that. So they make this very conspicuous silken tent. If you were to look at the caterpillar itself, they're going to be dark colored, but they have this white stripe running right down the middle of the back, bordered by some orange. And so that makes them pretty easy to identify. I do get calls about those caterpillars. Folks sometimes have the impression that they need to aggressively prune out that tent and burn it and things like that, which really isn't the case. They're not that nasty of a pest. If they are present in, a crabapple in your yard or an apple tree in your orchard and you want to deal with them, often something you could do is simply rip out that tent, maybe put a pair of gloves on and rip out the tent, or you could spray the tent itself. And what's nice about that approach is we're not spraying the entire tree. We're just spraying that tent directly. You could even use something such as insecticidal soap or soapy water to do that. And then that other tent caterpillar, the forest tent caterpillar, which does have the word tent in its name, but the forest tent caterpillar does not make a silken tent, but it's a very close relative of the eastern tent caterpillar. So same group of insects that we're talking about. That species is going to be about the same size, feeds on a range of plants. I often hear reports on plants such as aspens, but it can go to other hardwoods as well. And that one looks a little different. If you were to look at it running down the back rather than a solid white stripe, it has what look like little boot prints or whitish exclamation points And they're actually somewhat pretty caterpillars to look at, but they're really easy to identify with those white boot prints or exclamation points running down the middle of their back. So those would be the spongy moth, the two tent caterpillars we have this time of the year, and a little bit about them and how to tell them apart.
And the spongy moth, I have a friend who has a young oak tree, and she was removing the spongy moths from that. I mean, just physical removing was what she was doing. Anything else one can do?
Well, you really have to look at kind of the context that we're in. And this makes me think of the earlier caller with the black raspberry patch. If you have a huge area like a woodlot, your hands are really going to be tied because it's just going to be hard to do stuff. If you have an individual high-value tree in your yard, such as an oak, you could consider calling an arborist. They might be able to apply a treatment. There are some other options, such as hand removal, which you just mentioned, Larry. I'm a big fan and proponent of that. It turns out that when the spongy moths get big enough, they start becoming wary of predators such as birds. So they will hide during the day. They actually wander down from the tree canopy. They'll hide during the day. And so one thing you can do is take a piece of string and some burlap and tie it around the trunk of the tree. That gives them a hiding spot. What you have to do, though, is go out every single day and knock those into a container of soapy water to actually kill them. But that can be something you can do in your own yard. And then once it gets dark, if those caterpillars haven't been killed, they're going to wander up into the canopy of the tree to feed after dark. So they're always going up and down once they get to be big enough. But again, we can take advantage of that behavior, offer them a hiding spot, but then we can go and foil their plan by scooping them off on a daily basis. So that's something you can do in your own yard as well.
Let's take another call. Scott in Spring Green, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call and really love your show. It's a two-part question. When I'm out for a walk with my wife, she will be wearing all the wrong colors, dark colors, but the mosquitoes won't be after her at all. I'll be wearing light colors, and I'm like the Peanuts character Pigpen with a cloud of mosquitoes chasing me. So I've heard it might be based on blood type. She's type A or AB. I'm type O. Is there any truth to whether the mosquitoes prefer type O? The second question is that for gnat repellent, I use DEET and eucalyptus oil to keep the mosquitoes away successfully, and then I use Absorbine Junior to keep the gnats away when I'm on the golf course. Is Absorbine Junior truly effective for gnats, or do you have another recommendation?
Yeah, so good question about mosquitoes, and we do know that there are differences from person to person between you and I in terms of how attractive we may be to mosquitoes. And some folks, we just call them mosquito magnets because, as you alluded to, you can have a bunch of mosquitoes going after you, and someone else nearby you might not have as many. It turns out there's actually a lot of factors at play in a situation like that. You're right, though, blood type can play a role. We do know that type O, there can be an association with being slightly more attractive to mosquitoes. But there's a lot of other things. Some of it can involve our individual rates of metabolism. If you are running warmer, if you are putting off more carbon dioxide, for example, and there are some other cues associated with odor, these can play a role and might make you more attractive compared to someone else. We know there are also some individual habits and choices. Clothing can sometimes have an impact. Dark colors for mosquitoes and many budding flies will often be more attractive than light-colored clothing. There are some influences of alcohol consumption. If you are drinking like a beer or wine or cocktail, or if you're a regular drinker, that can actually alter some of the chemicals that we exhale in our breath. And so that can actually have an impact in terms of how attractive you are. So you're right. The blood type can play a role, but it's not just blood type. There's a lot of individual factors that can play a role in terms of how attractive you are to mosquitoes. Now, in terms of the absorbing, I've actually heard that many times. I don't recall seeing a scientific study on that, actually looking at something like absorbing. If you look at the ingredients in Absorbing Junior, I know there's some kind of plant-based essential oil-type ingredients in there, which do give it kind of a plant odor associated with it. So, again, I've heard of that absorbing junior acting as a repellent. I just haven't seen any actual study to really confirm that. In terms of the term gnat, though, that can really be a general term that can refer to a lot of different insects. And sometimes folks will refer to just about any small flying insect as a gnat, which does make it hard because there can be differences between these different types of small flying insects. So, again, I have heard some claims that absorbing junior can act as a repellent. I haven't seen it, but if it seems to be working in your situation, by all means, try it and see if that helps out.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm O-positive, so I have mosquitoes after me all the time, Scott, so and BJ, so maybe there is something to that blood type business. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Ray in Stevens Point, on to you now. Hi, Ray.
Hi, I have a question. I want your opinion on Thermacell, which is a product to repel mosquitoes. It's basically a butane cartridge that will fuel a small flame, and then above that flame you put a little repellent pad that emits something that repels the mosquitoes. I have found it to be remarkably effective, but I want to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah. So I have also found those to be remarkably effective. I would say you're absolutely right about the device. It's got this little heating element, and there's a pad which is impregnated with a type of pyrethroid, but it's one that volatilizes very easily. And essentially, when you turn these devices on, and there's Thermacell, I have seen some similar devices from like Johnson Wax, which has off bug spray, these little lantern things, for example. So there are some of these devices out there. What's nice about them is you basically turn the device on or light a candle in some cases. It vaporizes this repellent, which helps keep mosquitoes out of an area. It's usually kind of a bubble, if you think about it, maybe 5-10 feet radius or so. And that does seem to work very well. And then once you turn the device off, it dissipates very quickly. So that is a nice way in my mind that you can keep mosquitoes at bay, but also reduce impacts to beneficial insects around you. Because, again, you're not spraying your entire yard and have a residual out there for several weeks. This is something you turn on, and once you turn it off, within 5-10 minutes, it dissipates and it stops working. So personally, I'm a big fan of those. I know I've seen some good data backing them up that they do seem to work for mosquitoes and some other biting insects as well.
And so I could put that on my front porch in the evenings when I want to sit outside.
Yeah, I've got one of my own, and if I'm going out like mountain biking or I'm at a trailhead, I may turn that on if the mosquitoes or biting flies are out. It helps keep them at bay while I'm getting my bike ready, and then once I'm ready to hit the trail, I turn it off, put it in my car, and I'm good to go.
Let's go to Larry in Delta next. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Yes, I've got a question on bumblebees. Is it detrimental to feed them honey in the fall?
Bumblebees. Well, that's an interesting question. I would not have thought of that. I mean, the thing about bumblebees is they have annual colonies. And so that the colony in late summer, early fall is naturally going to die out anyways. So feeding them probably isn't really going to help them much, if at all. Because they're just simply going to perish. That's simply how their life cycle goes on. The colonies do produce a new batch of queens that will overwinter. Usually they'll go down amongst mulch or another sheltered location. And those can be out foraging pretty late into the season. And so if they were active, let's say if it were, you know, a surprisingly warm November day and there's no flowers out, but they're flying around and you were to give them a sugar source, that might be able to help them out simply because they're active that day. I feel in the vast majority of cases, it's probably not necessary to do anything like that because they're really evolved for finding those nectar sources that are still out there.
PJ Leash, our guest today, we're taking a look at the world of insects with him. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network as we look at the world of insects with P.J. Leash of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him with us today. You can join in, 800-642-1234, email to ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Leslie in Rhinelander next. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, hi. A couple things. I've got a place up here, but I do have a small farm in Tennessee, and we get Middle Tennessee. We get inundated with Japanese beetles. What works is, again, and it's great with PJ, is knowing your habitat, right, of each insect, and particularly with Japanese beetles when they first get going. They are not as active early in the morning or in the evenings. The best time, you can knock them off. You don't have to squish them if that, you know, woman doesn't want to squish bugs, but you can knock them easily off the plants and then just into a bucket of soapy water. And I have an orchard of elderberries and other berries, and that works all the time for me. So that's one thing. Second, ants, mounds. I have sometimes too many. And excuse me, PJ, correct me with my pronunciation, but I know it's organic. It's a earth, from the earth called, is it Diatomaceous?
Diatomaceous?
D-I-A. That's it. Thank you. Okay. And that's natural from our earth. And so I use that in a couple of the mounds that have gotten for the ants that have gotten out of control. That way I'm on waterway here up in Wisconsin, so I don't want anything, you know, leaching into the water. That works every time. I've used it for years in different places, and I find that really helpful. Third, anytime I have to use the DDT spray, I always, when I come in, I always wash it off, even with, you know, I just get that stuff off of my skin. And fourth is, and it's, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, called mosquito dunks, and it's organic, and it is, it can be used in different types of fish habitats. And if you've got standing water, or oh, like bird baths, or rain barrels, et cetera, you can use them, and they are biologically, from what I understand, that they're good, and you, it kills the mosquito larvae for 30 days. So I have found that very useful as well. So hoping that, I know some people, with the woman with the blackberries, definitely do this. You don't have to squish them. Just early in the morning, in the evening, bucket of soapy water, and they'll knock, you can knock them off. And the, as you said, PJ, the thing is to get them first thing as they're starting to come in, so that they're not attracting other Japanese beetles. So I hope that helps people.
Leslie, thanks so much. Comment, PJ, lots of things there from Leslie.
Really right about Japanese beetles, and they have these diurnal behaviors. If you're out first thing in the morning or around evening, you're just not going to see a whole lot of them. We know they really are active during warmer, sunnier parts of the day. And so if you are at home or able to work with them right when you get home from work, maybe 4 p.m. or something like that, that could be a consideration. But often I'd say between about noon and 4 is a good time to go and knock those off plants. I know during the early parts of the pandemic, when I was at home a lot, I would just take a break every couple of hours and go knock them off rose bushes and pole beans and stuff like that in the yard. And I really didn't have to do much spraying. Regarding the diatomaceous earth, that is something that is found at a lot of hardware stores and garden centers. My general impression, though, is outdoors, it doesn't seem to really hold up very well compared to indoors. The thing about diatomaceous earth, the way it works is on a microscopic scale, it essentially abrades the waxy coating on insects' bodies. It causes them to lose moisture to the atmosphere around them, and they desiccate, they dry out and die. And so if you use it in dry environments, it can work very well if applied correctly. And you really don't want to over-apply it. It's just enough to get the job done. So as an example, professional pest control folks will use diatomaceous earth in some cases, or something similar, which is basically powdered silica gel. They'll use that to control bed bugs indoors, and it can work very well, and that's a challenging pest to deal with. So under the right conditions, it can work, but often outdoors with moisture and things like that, I don't really hold a whole lot of weight with that for those types of locations. For the repellents like DEET, each repellent is going to differ, and that's why I mentioned earlier to really read all those instructions. Now, I did mention that one plant-based repellent, oil of lemon eucalyptus, and some of the products I've seen that contain that explicitly say when you're done, you have to come in and wash it off of your skin. So if there is information like that on the container, make sure you're always following those instructions. And then the last thing Leslie had mentioned was mosquito dunks. This kind of ties in with something I mentioned earlier, the BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a type of naturally occurring bacteria. And there's a strain, BTI, Bacillus thuringiensis israelensis, that can kill mosquito larvae. It won't impact the adult mosquitoes. It impacts the larvae. So what you can do with these dunks, and they also have, I think it's called mosquito bits, if I remember correctly. It's a granular formulation, but same general ingredient and concept. And you would put these into bodies of water where we know there may be mosquito larvae. And these little briquettes, the dunks, break down into little tiny particles, and mosquito larvae are actually in the water feeding on bits of breaking down leaves and things like that, essentially filter feeders. And so if they ingest little particles from these mosquito dunks, it disrupts their guts or digestive system. They end up dying. And so that can be one important part of a mosquito management plan. If you can go around your yard and either get rid of standing water, maybe in man-made items like a bird bath and things like that, but if you have water you can't get rid of, maybe you live in a wooded lot, you just have low-lying areas with standing water in it, that could be a situation where these mosquito dunks could be used. And again, it's going to help eliminate the mosquito larvae that are present in those areas. So that can be a really effective approach. And they are organic. They have a narrow spectrum of activity, so it's not going to be harming butterflies and bees and things like that. It's being applied to the water just to control those mosquito larvae.
Leslie, thanks again. Appreciate it. Carol emailed us a photo, PJ, and I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it. It's a bug she found in her yard. She says it may look creepy, but it actually is something that eats aphids. And I don't think it looks creepy.
Oh, I am just taking a peek at that, Larry. Let me see. And this is from Carol?
Yeah.
I don't know if I got that one, Larry.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Over our news break, we'll make sure that you get that. Jody Carol had emailed, do you have any advice on mosquito relief for people living near lakes?
Yeah, so I do have some thoughts, and I know earlier we discussed the mosquito treatments, and if you're having your yard treated with residual berry treatments, you know, that can pose some risk to other insects around you, but especially if you're up north, if you have something like a three-season porch or screened-in porch, if the mosquitoes are bad, sometimes it just makes more sense to hang out in there. We did discuss a couple minutes ago those thermocell devices, these little thermal devices, and there's some other manufacturers as well, where it uses heat to vaporize a repellent, an area repellent, which basically makes a bubble around you, and those can work very well. Some other thoughts, wearing long sleeves. I know this week it's pretty darn warm in Wisconsin, so it's hard to put on long pants and a long sleeve shirt. But if it's cool enough, that can be a physical barrier between the mosquitoes in your skin. The repellents like DEET, Picaridin, IR35, oil of lemon eucalyptus, those are some good options as well. A few other things, and I know, Larry, you've mentioned you will do this in your own yard, but setting up a strong fan or two to move some air, that can be a good way, because with their small body mass, if there's a good breeze, it's hard for them to fly through that and get to you. So those are some things that I think are some pretty simple solutions for what you can do to help keep mosquitoes at bay.
Kay in Wausau wonders, why are canker worms so plentiful in the North Woods? She's in Wausau right now.
Oh, that's really interesting. So I have not had any reports of canker worms here at the Insect Diagnostic Lab that I can think of so far this year. So I am not aware of any widespread ongoing issue. I might wonder in this case if there may be some sort of localized phenomenon, and that type of thing really wouldn't surprise me much. In any given year, there's always certain insects that are winners, so to speak, and losers. Some are higher, some are lower. And sometimes it can be a very localized phenomenon where maybe you had a local population last year, they did well, you got a bunch of eggs, and you ended up with more of those insects this year. So that would be my suspicion, is that it's probably not a widespread thing. It might be fairly localized in a case like this.
And Keith emailed, he's mixed vinegar, salt, and dish soap for weeds and found it to be quite effective to remove or repel the little red or brown pavement ants that make the mounds of dirt in the patios and sidewalks.
Oh, interesting. I had not heard of that kind of approach myself. You know, there's a lot of things out there that could use some research to figure out if they really do have some a scientific basis behind them or not.
PJ Leash, our guest today, as we talk the world of insects with him, and he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today, so you can join in. The number's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. And if you've got an insect photo, of course, we'd love to see that as well. Email it to ideas@WPR.org. We'll be back with PJ right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always fun to have PJ come by. And lots of people online and a lot of emails as well. So let's go back to the emails for a minute, PJ. Carol had emailed a photo of a bug she found in her yard. She says it may look creepy, but it's actually eating aphids. Did you get a chance to look at it?
I did find that one, Larry. So the insect that she sent in is actually the larva of a type of lady beetle. And both the larvae and adults of lady beetles, for almost all of our species, are beneficial predators of things such as aphids. And once you realize what these look like, you'll start finding them all over the place. It's amazing how common they can be. They're small, usually about a quarter of an inch long or so, black, often with some orange or sometimes yellowish on the body, may have kind of a spiky appearance. And one analogy I heard recently was that this a colleague of mine mentioned they look kind of like miniature alligators. And after I looked at the photo, I said, yeah, I can see that. So, yeah, these little black and orange spiky things, those are a good sign, especially if you have aphids on your garden or yard plants.
And Owen in Cornucopia emailed a photo of a rosy maple moth. It's a very pretty moth.
Yeah. When folks think about moths, they may have this negative impression because they think moths are drab. And it's somewhat true. A lot of the species are brown or gray or black, not a whole lot of color. But we do actually have some very colorful moths out there. And this rosy maple moth is a great example of that because these things are pretty good size as far as our moths go. And also, they're a very vibrant yellow and kind of a neon pink color with this very furry, shaggy appearance. So it looks like something out of the 1970s or something, but really cool as far as moths go.
Let's take another call. Tom in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good afternoon, I guess. My question is there a herbicide that I can put on my lawn to get rid of some weeds that won't negatively impact the insects?
Yeah, good question. And that's an interesting topic. I do have some colleagues in the entomology department that are doing some work along those lines. And at this point, we just don't have a complete picture. There needs to be more research done. Now, in general, if you're talking about herbicides, these are chemicals that specifically kill weeds. And so you might think, well, if they're only killing weeds and not insects, then we should be okay. But we know for some of these, the herbicides can have subtle kind of indirect impacts on insects, we're finding out. Some of my colleagues are working on bumblebees as an example. And bumblebees collect pollen and nectar. They then provision it and place it away in the nest. And the larvae would feed on that. And there's actually some microbes involved, the yeast, for example. And if some of the lawn chemicals are impacting the yeast that's associated with the food, that can have some indirect impact. So we're learning more and more about that all the time. Also, you could argue from the standpoint of if you're using an herbicide to take out all the weeds in your yard, to us, we may consider those plants weeds, but to insects, those could be sources of nectar and pollen. So that could be breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So if we get rid of the weeds there, you know, are we hurting them because we got rid of some of their food? So there's also that kind of point of the argument as well. Now, one thing you could consider if you do want your lawn to look a particular way, could you perhaps modify other parts of your yard to provide floral resources for bees and other pollinators, such as put in a perennial flower bed or annual flower bed, or put in some flowering trees and shrubs. That way you could have the lawn the way that you want, but you could still make sure to provide plenty of resources for pollinators around you. So in terms of herbicides specifically, we have some evidence out there that certain ones might play a role in disrupting insects, but I think a lot more research needs to be done.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it. Jane in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Jane.
Oh, hi. I had really good luck accidentally growing or raising a lot of dragonflies in a small pond. It was hardly a pond, a very small water feature in my past home. And I wonder, in my new home, I have a small pond. How do I attract dragonflies?
Yeah, good question. I know I have seen some articles online about basically dragonfly gardening, which would essentially be what you're talking about. One thing to keep in mind is that if you have a man-made water feature, that's basically a new environment for them. And so dragonflies would have to find it at some point. And it would have to be species that could suitably use that type of environment. So I'm not aware of any great things off the top of my head where you could necessarily really draw in or move dragonflies into your area. But I would suspect that if the body of water is big enough that some species could use it, over time, they probably will trickle in and find it, and then you may have some breeding in your own backyard.
There you go, Jane. Thank you for calling. Tim in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. In the last week, I found some large black ants all around different parts of the house, and I'm wondering, how do I know if that's a carpenter ant, and is there something that I can do to remedy that, or is that a commercial? Would it be better to hire a commercial a business to do it?
Sure. Well, whenever I hear the term large black ants, I do, of course, get a little bit nervous about carpenter ants. Roughly how large is large in this case?
At least half an inch to three quarter.
Okay. Yeah, with that size, those would have to be carpenter ants. Those would most likely be some of the queens, which would suggest the presence of a nest. For most of our carpenter ants, the workers are going to be smaller, more in the range of maybe around quarter inch, give or take. They can actually, if it's a large colony, you can have different size workers. So the fact that you're finding multiple very, very large ants like that, again, does point to carpenter ants. In terms of what to do about it, that is really a big question. And in my mind, carpenter ants can be a bit more challenging to deal with compared to some of our other ants because there can be a lot of different scenarios at play. What I'm getting at is you could have a situation where there's a nest outside and you simply have some carpenter ants wandering inside to look for food. That would be a more kind of a simpler scenario to deal with. In a case like this, it sounds like you could have potentially a nest present. They're often associated with water-damaged wood. However, sometimes carpenter ants can nest in like styrofoam, that pink or blue foam board used as insulation. That's similar density and texture to rotting wood. So sometimes there can be nests and things like that. One of the best things that you could probably do at the moment would be to simply watch the ants. And I know when you see them, your first gut instinct may be to squish them, but it can really pay off to sit there and watch the ants for a while because if you see them coming or going from particular areas, and you might need to watch them for 30, 60 minutes sometimes, But if, especially if there were worker ants present, you may be able to localize and figure out where nests might be. You could kind of pinpoint it down to a certain wall void or attic area or something like that, and that helps narrow down our search. If you are doing this detective work and you can actually find the nest, or you know generally where it is, there are some ways, some insecticide treatments that could be applied to that area. If it is tucked away in a spot where we really can't get to, then the pest control professionals do have some products that are formulated differently, such as dusts or powders. Sometimes they may do things like take off the outlet plate covers to get into wall voids and puff those products into locations like that. Sometimes they may actually drill small holes if they know that a nest is in a wall void in a certain spot, drill holes, inject it into the wall void, and then seal it up when they're done. But as I mentioned, an important thing to do for now is watch them, see if you can figure out where they're coming from, where they're going to. There are also some bait products out there that can work against carpenter ants. However, I will caution you that the baits that you and I can find at the hardware store usually don't work particularly well against carpenter ants. The common like liquid taro baits and things like that, there are some more professional grade baits that pest control professionals would have, or you can sometimes order them online. Also, if you do decide to try and bait, it's worth mentioning that baiting for carpenter ants can sometimes be a long process if there is a well-established nest present. Some studies I've seen in the literature, it can take 8, 10, 12 weeks. So that's, you know, three-ish plus months. In other cases, it might go faster than that. It kind of depends on the product, the formulation, the ingredients. So I'd start by watching the ants. If you just can't figure out where a nest is, I do often suggest to folks with carpenter ants to contact a pest control professional, because they often have a lot of experience dealing with these, and they'll have the products and equipment on hand to be able to deal with them.
Tim, good luck. Thank you so much. Tanya, in Stevens Point, what's on your mind?
Hi. So I was interested in the beneficial nematodes. And I mean, I sprayed those in my yard a couple years ago for chicks and fleas, and it seemed to work quite well, actually. They're usually found from a company called Arbico, I believe is the name of the company. But it's a nematode that you spray. It's a powder, and they're live little larvae, basically, that goes in and eats the larvae of the insects that you don't want. But they keep the good insects still in your yard.
Hmm. What do you think, PJ?
Yeah, so I've certainly heard of these. We refer to them as entomopathogenic nematodes. These are little nematodes or roundworms that can parasitize a range of insects. They won't necessarily stay just with the pests, though. They can go after other things as well. Some of these nematode species aren't particularly picky. Some of them can be a little bit pickier, so to speak. They aren't usually super common, or they're a little bit harder to find. The company that you mentioned, Arbico Organics, that is a common one that I think of. I've heard of a couple other vendors out there as well. So you can get these. I will caution with the nematodes. They can be, first of all, somewhat pricey to use, more expensive than conventional products. Also, they can be pretty sensitive to environmental conditions. They need just enough moisture. If they're out in sunlight and UV light, that can actually kind of zap them and kill them. And so they can be kind of sensitive. It's not the sort of thing that you usually just spray in your lawn and have them persist and control insects forever. That usually isn't how it works. You'd often have to spray these several times. I have seen some studies where these have been used with pretty good success in very controlled conditions, like in greenhouse settings. But again, outdoors, they can be kind of finicky. It also depends on the nematode species that you choose. Some of these entomopathogenic nematodes, we refer to them in the literature as cruisers, because they actually are quite mobile and they cruise around and they look for prey that they then get into, they reproduce, and they release more nematodes into the environment. And so those can kind of patrol around and help control pests. There are other nematodes that we refer to as ambushers, and they just kind of sit there and they don't move a whole lot. And so if you have a pest that is also relatively immobile and not moving a whole lot, those usually will not work well together because the ambushers are just sitting there. Versus if you had active pests that are moving around and might encounter them, then it can work. So they sound good in theory. I have seen some results in controlled situations. Again, outdoors and yards, they can be pricey. Also, the results can vary quite a bit.
Tanya, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Matt in Wausau emailed, wondered, was worried a bit about June bugs. He hasn't seen many in quantities compared, you know, the last couple of years compared to before that.
Yeah, so with June bugs, or also known as May June beetles, we actually have 29 species known from the state. And almost all of these, 28 of them, have a three-year life cycle. And so what that means is you can often have very localized phenomenon where you may see lots of them 1 year or maybe 2 years if you have overlapping species or overlapping generations. But then sometimes you will bump into a very quiet year. So that doesn't surprise me too much. What may happen is next year or the year after that, you may bump into pretty good numbers of them again. And that's a common phenomenon that I see around the entire Midwest when it comes to our May-June beetles.
Tiffany emailed to ask the name of the device you turn on and off to keep mosquitoes away. She may have been referring to the thermocell repellents.
Yeah, the thermocell is a very common one that I know of. There's a couple other ones. I'm pretty sure I've seen some from SC Johnson where it doesn't have a heating element, but it uses a little candle for the same process. It heats up this pad, it volatilizes this repellent, and that can work as well. But thermocell is a very common one that you'll bump into at a lot of stores.
Bill in Oregon emailed, keeping mosquitoes out of your bird bath is pretty simple in his mind, and he does what I do. You just dump, rinse, and refill your bird bath every few days. Takes a bit for larvae to become adults, and the jet setting on your garden nozzle is adequate to remove eggs, larvae, and some other algae. So a good tip there. I've done that pretty successfully.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point you just brought up, Larry, that you do need to keep on top of the standing water in your yard because mosquitoes, some of them can go through multiple generations per year, and you really don't want water standing for very long. So I suggest at least once a week, more than that certainly is great as well, but at least once a week to make sure to take the bird bath, the other items in your yard, clear the water out of them. That's going to help prevent some localized mosquito breeding in your own area.
Mary in New London emailed a photo of a white spotted beetle with mites around its thorax. I don't have you seen that? She's wondering what it is, and what could you tell her about the mites?
Yeah, so this insect that she had sent in the pictures of looks like a very common type of longhorn beetle. This is a family Cerambycidae. A lot of beetle collectors are fond of this family because a lot of the species are very, very charismatic with bright colors. This species that we see, the white-spotted Sawyer, is really quite common. Just about anywhere you have conifers, the larvae are associated with dead or dying conifers. The adult, when it emerges, is usually pretty good size. They're often maybe about an inch long or so, although the antennae can be extremely long, longer than the body itself. So those antennae might be an inch, inch and a half, 2 inches sometimes, can make a pretty large, impressive-looking insect. They're mostly blackish, but right in the middle of their back, so to speak, on us, it'd be kind of right between our shoulder blades if you thought about it that way. But there's this little whitish heart-shaped structure, and that's a key feature to identify this particular species. Now, what's interesting about it is most of the time that I see these white-spotted Sawyers, is they are covered with little tiny mites. And there's actually a lot of research that's been done because it's not necessarily one single type of mite. You can get many different types of mites that will either hang out on, and sometimes these mites are just hitching a ride from one location to another. So anytime you start looking at beetles, especially ones that live like on conifers or under the bark of trees, you'll start looking and seeing very tiny mites on them. So it's really a pretty common phenomenon to see that.
I saw a great video you did, PJ, about pollinators for UW-Madison's Were You Wondering? I thought it was really cool. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is something that we had in the works for several weeks now, and we just released it yesterday with folks from the UW-Madison Communications Group, and it's a short, about 2 to 3 minute video clip, simply talking about the many ways or some of the important ways that insects really help us out as humans. And I understand, you know, a lot of times we see insects, they may be doing something bad for us, nibbling on our garden plants or mosquitoes biting us and things like that. But if you stop and think about it, mosquitoes do some really important things like serving as pollinators, helping break down fallen plant material and materials in compost piles, and helping control pests around us. We have many, many species of insects that are beneficial predators and parasites. And so that's a video that if you want to learn a little bit more, it's a short kind of fun video clip, lots of great pictures and videos, and I'd encourage you all to check that out.
There's a link on our program notes, today's show, ideas at WPR.org/Larry, and you can find the link there to it. Barbara in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. PJ, you know I found a European chafer grub in Milwaukee, and the beetle looks like a June bug, but can you help us differentiate a chafer beetle bug from a June bug?
Sure. Unfortunately, without a microscope, it is somewhat hard to do because, as you just mentioned, the European chafer adults can look quite a bit like our typical May or June beetles. The timing is going to be a little bit different, though. So by now, in many parts of the state, the adults of May, June beetles are starting to wind down for the year. So like usually mid-May to mid-June or so. With the European chafers, they're usually out a little bit later, and I know that you had recently seen the grubs, and those are likely pupae in the area, so adults should be coming out in the near future. So again, visually, they're going to be somewhat hard to tell apart, but due to the timing, that can be a helpful clue. Otherwise, in my mind, you really need to get them up close and look at some of the features under magnification to help tell some of those scarab beetles apart.
A difficult task for most of us, but that's something you do every day, PJ.
Exactly.
Well, I tell you what, it's always a pleasure to have you come by. We had lots of questions today. I don't even know how many we answered, that you answered, I should say, but it was a lot, and I really appreciate your time and look forward to your next visit. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry.
PJ Leash is the manager of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he comes by generally every couple of months to talk with us about insects. Phil Pelletieri also stops by as well, the former director of the lab. Just looking ahead to tomorrow, talking finances, there's going to be some big news today on interest rates. And tomorrow, Frank Armstrong, a financial advisor, will be on to talk about bear markets and other investing topics. That's Thursday starting at 11. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.